This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Loo Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Toon are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Hey there, Place to Be Nation pop listeners. This is producer of the Hard Traveling Van Boys, Todd Weber. How are you? Just want to preface this episode of Hard Traveling Van Boys with a notice that we had some recording issues, as is wont to do with shows like this, where we have Skype calls and there's going to be some issues you hear in the first half where there's people talking over one another. Well, people, Greg and Nick talking over one another, or there's just one who can hear each other, but they can't be heard on the recording. I've done my best to cobble this together into one coherent recording, and we will go from there. But without further ado, you have been warned. This is Hard Traveling Fanboys 148, Man of Steel Revisited.
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo. Rapmaster PN News kicking us off here on a brand new episode of the Hard Travel Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips. With me at my side in the L-shaped studio, Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, as always, is Nick Duke. Nick, boy, we've got a happening show for the folks tonight, don't we?
We absolutely do. And I gotta say, Greg, that was pretty good stuff. You know, that little yo baby that you led the show off with. I'm a pretty big fan of your rapping skills, so much so I think you ought to see if Chris Jericho would be willing to book you for his cruise coming up later this year.
I will offer no comment on that at this time.
Why not?
None of that's for me to say. None of that's for me to say. What I will say is that the Rapmaster PN News is unlikely to be on the 2019 version of the Cruise of Jericho.
Mm-hmm. But maybe other rappers will, like yourself.
Maybe so. Mm-hmm. Who would you have in mind?
You. I said that a moment ago.
Other than me, I'm not a.
I don't know. I don't know of any credible rappers other than you.
I'm not a real rapist.
Well, I don't know of any,
as the kids say. I'm gonna preemptively prevent myself from using the term rapist again. It's a little bit too close to another word. But
David Sunday would also be acceptable for booking on the Jericho Cruise, I think.
Oh, really?
Performing a variety of Jay-Z hits, of course.
One in particular I can think of.
There are a few. There might be a couple.
Yes. We are, we of course are here bringing to you the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation. Mm-hmm. And, we're bringing you an episode of Off the Page. This is our monthly episode where we take a look at a piece of comic book media that is not an actual comic book. This can be, usually takes the form of movies, but sometimes it can be TV shows. It can be, what else? Games. And there are many other things that we've talked about doing but have never done, such as radio shows, scripts, things of that nature that we will get around to at some point. But this week, we're turning back to the big screen because, as anybody that's been a longtime fan of the Hard Traveling Fanboys knows, February is typically a month reserved for us to show our love for things. I mean, love is in the air. Cupid's throwing back his bow and shooting arrows into the sky, and lovers are intertwining their bodies on bedsheets nationwide. And so we here at the HTF Studios, we like to turn for 1 month into the heart-traveling fanboys as we shine a little light on things that we love. And in this month's Off the Page, we're going to shed a little love or a little light on something that we love that a lot of people don't love, which is kind of an odd situation for us to be in, Nick, because typically, you know, we're not that on the outskirts of things that we like typically. And sometimes we'll even take things that it's not often that we take something that is beloved and just tear it down. But we're going to do that in the inverted order of that I just said it. We're going to take something that is hated by some and build it up and make it, well, great again. Right, Nick?
That is what we do. We are all about making comics great again here on this show. And that, of course, is by excluding people who don't look like us.
That's right. Which would be the vast majority of comic book characters.
Yes.
Basically, we're talking about Archie for the rest of our existence. No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. Nick is, as after all, a noted anti-Archite.
Not true. Not an accurate statement.
But what we are going to do tonight is talk to you about a movie that divided audiences, divided critics, and to this day is one of those movies that the mention of can draw eye rolls and ire from one end of the aisle and can draw manifestos of praise from the other side. And that's a movie called Man of Steel. This came out, of course, in 2013 and was the first Superman movie to come out since 2006's Superman Returns, which itself was the first Superman movie in 20 years. So you figure there's been, before Man of Steel, there'd been one Superman movie over the course of a nearly 30-year span. So...
And it sucked.
This was, yeah, well, yeah, largely, yes, yes. this was a, I still will defend aspects of it. But yes, it was, it certainly had its many, many, many foibles. But this was a chance, or an attempt, rather, to relaunch the franchise of Superman, a character who, other than Batman, is far and away DC's most recognizable character. Their most iconic character, the oldest superhero character in comics, the one that started it all. Everybody knows who Superman is, but they just had not found a way to capitalize on that fandom on the big screen. In the meantime, DC had watched Marvel launch franchises out of, quite frankly, B-list characters across largely. Taking their not as popular characters and turning them into A-listers, whether it be the, you know, Black Widow and Hawkeye or characters like that, or even Iron Man and Captain America, who is certainly an A-list character, but not nearly the level of popularity that Spider-Man and the X-Men had. So Marvel had already shown the formula. They had already had so much success with this, whereas DC had only had success with one very specific vision. At least in recent memory, and that was Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy. That was very successful. Superman Returns, less successful. Green Lantern, certainly less successful. Projects like Catwoman came up occasionally, also not successful. And really, DC had floundered everywhere except the small screen for many, many years outside of the Batman franchise. So, what do they do with their relaunch of Superman? Well, first of all, they tried for many years to get Christopher Nolan to sort of spearhead this project. They wanted a Nolan Superman movie to tie into his Batman movies. Nolan was not, and you know more about the behind the scenes on this than I do, Nick, but as I understand it, Chris Nolan was not so much interested in directing a Superman movie. And really for years said that he wouldn't do that. He had no interest in it, that they wouldn't fit in his world. And yet suddenly he said he has an idea, a spark of an idea for what to do with Superman. And then I'll let you take it from there, Nick, and kind of fill in the blanks on how Nolan's interest kind of led to this project even happening.
Yeah, so basically, I believe it was while working on The Dark Knight and possibly even Into the Dark Knight Rises, Nolan kind of came up with this idea of, like, what if he were to be interested in a Superman movie, kind of what he would want to see out of a modern take. You have to remember, you know, for people who are down on the sense of wonder he got as a child watching the 1978 Superman movie on the big screen for the first time. And so he showed it to his cast and crew as an effort to let it influence what they were about to do in some subtle ways. So Nolan held the movie, the previous franchise in high regard as well. But he came up with this idea and basically told Warner Brothers that he would be willing to work on the script alongside longtime writing partner David Goyer, who had worked on all of the Batman movies with him to that point. But that he did not have interest in directing, as he was going to move on after the conclusion of The Dark Knight Rises and work on, I believe he was getting ready for Interstellar to come out at that point. That was his next big project and was already deep into production on it, pre-production on it, I should say. Could not direct Man of Steel, but would serve as a producer and provide the story. And so it was up to Warner Brothers from there to find the right director for the job. And as we all know now, without Chris Nolan being willing to shepherd the entire universe and only willing to shepherd really this one movie from a production standpoint, it led to one of the most infamous decisions in superhero movie history at this point, with the selection of Zack Snyder, not just as director of this film, but eventually the overseer of the entire short-lived DC Extended Universe.
Yes, and with all that being said, what we like to do here is watch the movie to kind of remind us of things. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear to be streaming anywhere right now, so I've got my Blu-ray copy sitting in my PS4 Pro here, and I am getting ready to hit play, and when I do, I'll invite all of you to do the same and watch along with us. We're not going to watch the entire movie or even close to it. This is a pretty long movie. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to watch have it on while we're having this discussion, and we'll wrap up at an appropriate time. But if you have your DVD or Blu-ray or 4K version handy, go ahead and hit play in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and play. So, tell us about that vision that Nolan had for a Superman movie. You mentioned that if he wanted to do a Superman movie, what would his angle be on it? What would he want to see in it? And what was that sort of central premise that he had?
Well, you kind of talk about, you talked about how his, or we've talked about before on the show, how his approach to Batman was kind of grounded in reality. He approached Batman through the lens of, what would this look like in the real world? How could this possibly happen? What would the reaction be? You know, what would that look like for a very gritty, realistic take on Batman? That's what he delivered in his film trilogy, at least up until The Dark Knight Rises. And we could have that debate on the bombast of that film another day. It's another debate that you and I don't really have much interest in having because we think everyone is wrong about it. But for Superman, there really is no way to approach the character of Superman realistically, right? You know, there's just not. So Nolan's approach was, if I can't approach the character himself realistically, I can't approach the way our world would react to the existence of this character realistically. What kind of challenges would he face in just normal everyday life? What kind of challenges would he face integrating with society? What kind of parenting approach would we see from Ma and Pa Kent, who typically in the comics portrayed as just these borderline infallible parents who are just, you know, kindly old people who are just too damn good to ever mess up. But in the real world, these parents would have deep and bare bones, very minimalist in a sort of way. And so Nolan kind of wanted to spend a little bit more time on Krypton and kind of fully flesh out what that version of it looks like and looked like in his head. And so he spent a good chunk of the script here, as you see, on Krypton. And it kind of leads to like about 12 minutes, a 12-minute prologue or so that features – here you see Russell Crowe as this version of Jor-El, you know, speaking to the High Council on Krypton and stuff like that. And so really those are the two ways. Focus more on Krypton and also give us a lens, a realistic lens that our world today might view Superman through. Perhaps, I think it could be argued, fairly a bit more skeptical lens and not as bright and optimistic as the original Donner Superman film.
Yes, agreed on that. This take on Krypton, or Krypton indeed, is highly influenced by a book that we actually reviewed not too long ago right here on the show, which is John Byrne's Man of Steel, the Brestular comic on which this movie is titled. And the look of Krypton, I remember watching this in the theater, and that was the first thing that stood out to me. Is I've talked about on previous shows, I think, that we've done, particularly in group settings, that Krypton has always been the least interesting aspect of Superman's mythos to me. I like Metropolis. I like Smallville. I like Clark Kent a lot more than I like Kal-El. But this movie does a better job than I have seen on screen in any iteration, even on the animated series, of making me care about Krypton in a way that I really never have. And I would say that's the same thing that we found, Nick, in John Byrne's Man of Steel, which almost melds sort of like a middle ground between what we talked about with that Richard Donner version and this version, where it's a cold and lifeless world emotionally. Remember that there's the classic Lara being aghast at Ma and Pa Kent having relations or whatever on Earth. And she can't even fathom the thought of a man looking at a woman in such a lecherous way. But that Byrne look and feel of Krypton is very much what I get here. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things we talked about when we did that review, is kind of, you know, me having never read that book before, I could definitely see the Man of Steel, you know, the ties between the book and the movie when we saw that. And it's much appreciated, because growing up, the version of Krypton that I was most familiar with was that Donner version, because I wasn't really a big Superman fan, as we will discuss, I'm sure, throughout this. And so it was kind of refreshing for me to see something that had a little bit more life to it, a little bit more visual, you know, pop to it, something a bit more dynamic than just that particular take.
Something dynamic like Jor-El riding a dragon.
Hey, man, it's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, I agree. This is the first time in my life I ever thought, you know what, I'd like to see a Jor-El movie, which also makes it one of the only times in my life I've ever said, I'd like to see a prequel. So, as you know, we've talked about my stance on prequels typically, but yeah, the dragon here is awesome. The really quickly, that piece of technology that we saw a minute ago, the little like floating oval communication device / personal assistant that we're seeing right here, it's called Kelex, which is a John Byrne creation back from the 80s that was – this whole thing was from his mind, to my knowledge. These sort of floating personal assistants of sorts on Krypton, the artificial intelligence that helps Jor-El and his kind out with basic household chores, with running their lives, basically. And, of course, this would also lead to the Eradicator, which came a couple of years later from the Roger Stern, Dan Juergens crew. But all of this visualization and the concept of the Kryptonian Codex, where there is no natural childbirth on Krypton. Everybody is sort of assigned a role from birth, and they're birthed in these matrices that sort of pop them out. And then they're kind of coldly positioned into a role where you're a warrior, or you're a scientist, or you're a mathematician, or you're a farmer, or whatever it may be. And this movie sort of works on that established modern Superman canon, where he's kind of the first natural birth, as Jor-El says, in hundreds of years, and sort of represents a re-embracing of their quote human side that they've kind of gotten away from. One of the recurring themes in Superman comics over the years has been that Krypton allowed itself to stray too far from its emotions and to focus too much on the intellect versus the emotion as sort of the flip side of humanity. And Superman representing a bridge of those two worlds. And that's certainly what you see here. And this is a pretty cool damn action sequence, actually, with Jor-El and the creature as they're flying around, and he's trying to escape from General Zod, played by Michael Shannon, who just attempted to do a coup here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I agree with you, Nick, that establishing this visual dynamic and this more interesting-looking Krypton, and importantly, there's no way I think to talk about this movie really and put it in context without talking about Superman Returns, right?
No, absolutely.
So, Superman Returns, for better or worse, for the thing that it did well, it ultimately suffered from people feeling that it had a distinct lack of action. In other words, the action in that movie was primarily Superman versus nature. Superman lifting a rock, Superman lifting boulders, Superman stopping a tidal wave, or Superman stopping a plane crash, things like that. There wasn't much in the way of actual physical
action. Sorry, not to derail you here, but we must mention that this, of course, Laura L. here, played by the woman who would become Vanessa.
Yes, and I gotta say, on rewatch, she was the one actor in this movie that really didn't do it for me.
Luckily, she's only in it like about 30 more seconds.
Yeah, she has very little to do here, but what she does is not good. Very forced, very heavy-handed, in my opinion. But yes, nonetheless. So, Superman Returns is criticized for a lack of action. That there's just not enough going on. There's not enough happening.
Well, lack of action, and also, like, you know, as much as people want to talk about this movie having characterizations and actions taken by Superman that are out of character for the classically defined Superman, I would argue Super Stalker Superman and Deadbeat Dad Superman are not exactly in the classically defined Superman character the way they were portrayed in Man of Steel, or excuse me, in Superman Returns.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, certainly, to criticize about that. And that's not even getting into the over-reverence to Kate, the point of...
Or the Kate Bosworth of it all.
Oh, my Lord. No, we'll get to her. But the... or maybe we won't. I don't know. But the lack of action was a big criticism of Superman Returns. So right out of the gate, Man of Steel is establishing itself as different, which we figured it would, being a movie directed by Zack Snyder, who's known for his big action set pieces. But right out of the gate, we've just gotten two things that fly in the face of the Richard Donner and particularly the Bryan Singer Superman movies, which is a focus on fisticuffs and action and Krypton and otherworldliness,
yeah.
In other words.
Again, as someone who does not have a fantastic reverence for the Donner films, I always liked the original one well enough when I was a kid, because even as a kid I could go, oh, this movie's kind of old. They couldn't do a lot of the cool things I'd like to see Superman do in a movie, because the idea of the character of Superman and his power set is you can literally create as big an action scene as you want to. There are no constraints to what you can do with this character. And so in the build-up to Superman Returns in 2006, the idea, I think, in everybody's head was, or in my head at least...
Yes, with modern technology.
Modern technology, yeah. And this character, there is no limit to what you can put on the screen. And it's not even like the action we got was bad. It's that they didn't even try, which is the frustrating part.
Yes, absolutely.
And this makes the decision that it is not going to repeat that mistake, regardless of what other mistakes it might make along the way.
One area that is repeated in this movie is the use of the villain General Zod, of course, mm-hmm. who was used to great effect in Superman 2. And it would have been impossible to follow up that classic performance in the same vein that was done in that movie with the trio of Kryptonians. So what they do is they cast Michael Shannon as a different version of General Zod.
A super same intense character, version.
But a super intense. This is a General Zod who has been bred from birth to be a warrior, to be a military man. And he is his sole purpose in life, much like the character of the Eradicator in the comics, his sole purpose in life is to preserve Krypton. He wants to take Krypton and make sure that it is as safe as it can possibly be at the expense of anything else. Nothing else matters to him except the preservation of his people. This puts him at odds with Jor-El, of course, and it also leads to him being a fascinating and intense villain for a Clark Kent, because Clark, in this movie, over the course of this movie, finds out that he is Kryptonian and finds out who his parents are and about his heritage. And here you have the ultimate Kryptonian, someone who is completely steeped in old Kryptonian culture. And then you have Clark, who has no Kryptonian culture, and what happens when these two forces collide with one another. It's much more visceral and much more physical than perhaps the battle in Superman 2, which is philosophical in nature. It does have a cool battle scene as well. But this is, we know right out of the gates, this is going to be intense, and this is going to be a very uphill climb for our hero, because you know Zod's going to eventually catch him and find him. Now, one thing that didn't sit well with me is Jor-El beating up Zod in a fist fight, because if Zod has been bred from birth to be a general, to be a military man, mm-hmm. and a warrior, and Jor-El presumably has been bred from birth to be a scientist,
yes.
It's hard for me to believe that Zod...
He's a scientist, so he's been creating those Kryptonian PEDs in his spare time, preparing himself for this moment.
You suggesting that he's been building Kryptonian hurting bombs?
Kryptonian hurting bombs, a little KGH, Kryptonian growth hormone.
Oh...
That's my theory, anyway.
I like it. I like it, Nick. And it would certainly make sense. That's how he was able to get the advantage on Zod. He's given him the scar that will last the duration of the film. But also this movie makes the decision, mm-hmm. as did John Byrne's Man of Steel, to eschew all the other elements of Kryptonian folklore, such as Supergirl, Crypto, all of that stuff. He is, at least in this one movie, while there is definitely room that they could have expanded on the mythology later, I think, which we'll talk about later. In this movie, he is the last son of Krypton, and this is the sort of focus on that the movie takes, is he's been sent from Krypton. This is the last we'll see of Krypton until later in the film, as Zod is going to face the council and, of course, have his immortal line, Nick. I will find them!
Michael Shannon is not afraid to go big in this movie, which is, I think, does the movie a service rather than a disservice.
I agree. I mean, it's over the top. It's. But, you know, I have really grown softer in my older age on over-the-top comic book performances, and I think Shannon is... First of all, I think Michael Shannon's great for the entire movie.
Are you suggesting that it's time, finally, to look back at that first Spider-Man movie for the podcast at some point?
I'm saying we're going to do that at some point, and maybe I will view it in a different light, a certain performance in that movie. And I'm going to say it. Another character in this movie that I believe is an original for the film, I could be wrong on that, and if I am, I apologize to absolutely nobody, bro. But a character that may be an original in the film is Feyora, who sort of takes the place of Ursa. And Nick, I have to say that given your recent predilection, as you say, for women who could beat the hell out of you,
yep.
What are your thoughts on Feyora?
Fair, decent, not too shabby. Look at the dicks. There go all the dicks.
The dicks. Yes. The phallic, the giant phallic symbols that are being sent up into the Phantom Zone.
I much prefer dick Phantom Zone to glass Phantom Zone, personally.
Yes. Send in the dicks.
Just a big old ring of dicks. Theater,
it's like, this is a very phallic culture. But we know we talked about that in John Byrne's Man of Steel, about there's a very sort of phallic nature to everything on Christmas.
Yeah, I don't think it was because the filmmakers were obsessed with dicks. I think they were honestly trying to look for, you know, some
they were trying to honor John Byrne's obsession with dicks.
And perhaps there's a bit of a story there in that it seems like all the movers and shakers on Krypton, the people who have the power, typically are male. We see the one female who is blown away by Zod on the council. And then the rest of it is about Zod and Jor-El and, like, you know, these other council members.
Laura also is kind of lacking in agency. Right. Which is a criticism I've heard that I do agree. Show that they're going to be different from Superman Returns. Action-focused, modern technology used to its greatest effect. And director Zack Snyder, who we should talk about at this point, I mentioned he's known for his action set pieces. He's also known for very heavy CGI films, really going all the way back to Watchmen, which had, of course, the Dr. Manhattan sequences that are completely CGI'd. 300. 300 was almost entirely CGI'd. Mm-hmm. So he's been known for this throughout his career. And when he was announced for this project, I know now the name Zack Snyder kind of carries with it certain connotations on account of the state of the DCEU. However, I will maintain this. Up to this point in his filmography, I had, to some degree or another, enjoyed every scene of every movie of his that I had seen, except for Sucker Punch.
Yeah, and I've still never seen Sucker Punch. And like you said, he was a noted director of action and of special effects. And after, again, you have to put it in the context of a post Superman Returns landscape, where after Superman Returns, Warner Brothers was going to make damn sure they had competent action in this movie. And now we're transitioning on the screen to kind of the first look at Christopher Nolan's influence on the story, where in true Nolan fashion, we're going to start to tell the story in a non-linear fashion. It's going to jump around throughout Clark's life.
Does this part of the story not remind you of Batman Begins?
Oh, absolutely it does. And I think that was intentional on his point.
Totally agreed. I thought it, the first time I watched this was like, this was so for me because it was paralleling in many ways Bruce's story at the beginning of Batman Begins,
right,
to what we see here with Clark. So, but yeah, the Zack Snyder aspect of it, Dawn of the Dead remake, excellent. 300 was good for what it was. Watchmen, I still think is an excellent movie.
I do too.
And probably his best movie. But, you know, all of that. Now, granted, it's fair to say that all of those were adaptations of other people's writing. As was this, by the way, because this is a script by David Goyer and Christopher Nolan, or by David Goyer, based on a story by Goyer and Nolan. So where Snyder has really kind of gone astray over the years is when he kind of controls the story itself. But here, there was one little bit of shaky CGI there where Clark jumped over, but oh no, that hasn't happened yet. I take that back. I'm ahead of myself. But yeah, good stuff here. A little bit of a parallel with Aquaman as well. The submarine scene where he pulls the door off, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
And some people believe you can actually see this scene in Aquaman when Ocean Master is talking about all the evil that the surface has wrought upon the world. They show an oil rig burning, and some have theorized it's supposed to be this oil rig.
Some have also theorized that when the shot of the sea life comes to Clark when he's floating around, that was an allusion to Aquaman.
In this film, yes.
Yeah. So, again, that's establishing the Zack Snyder of it all. And as you mentioned, this is the Christopher Nolan of the project. This is the nonlinear storytelling, picking us up sort of in media res, where Clark's already a grown adult on Earth, but we're not going to pick up the story necessarily directly from this point. We're going to use this as our starting point to launch back into a story of who he is and how he came to be. Mm-hmm. As we saw in Batman Begin with the sequence of Bruce starting out in the prison and then kind of flashing back to who he was as a kid, how he got his, how he got his training, to get to the point where he is now, when he first returned to Gotham City and how that turned out for him, things of that nature. So there's a lot of parallels here. And here we kick off one of my favorite parts of this movie that I want to talk about all of the stuff we talk a lot about on this movie, and we have a lot on this show, and we have a lot of debates about kid actors and about movies and shows that focus on kids. We've gone back and forth on that. You know, you hate some of them, I hate some of them, but this every scene involving young Clark in this movie works for me better than any other iteration of kid Clark that I've seen.
I agree.
This in particular, this scene in the school, in my opinion, and this is coming from a big Superman fan, this is one of my favorite scenes of Superman in all of pop culture. Not Superman, I guess, but Clark Kent. I love it. I absolutely love this.
Because it humanizes him. And that's something you'll hear me say over the course of this film, is like the reason I think I love it so much is because I've always found my barrier to Superman for the longest time was I could not find him relatable in the least or even interesting because his goodness, his basic ability to be, as Tim Capel puts it, the best fucking person, is something that I cannot comprehend or even like understand and don't honestly find that much entertainment in. There is an actual character arc here, and I think that is what I hooked onto in this movie more so than anything.
Totally agree, and I think my argument is that that's generally the modern version of Superman. That is what John Byrne and others built onto from what he did, is a Superman who has been, quote, Marvelized, for lack of a better term. But what I love about this scene is it's the best episodes of Smallville, which was a great Superman adaptation, in my opinion, in the early seasons, were the ones that dealt with Clark struggling with who he was and what his powers were. And in particular, I remember the episode where he develops heat vision and how that is explored on the show. And they do it in kind of a humorous kind of way at times. But what this movie does is really focus on the reality of what if you suddenly were sitting at school and all of a sudden you hear every conversation that everyone's having around the room, not just around the room, but around the school and outside the school. And suddenly you can see through your teachers and you can see through your classmates with your X-ray vision. You're getting sensory overload. And Clark just shuts down. He doesn't know how to react. He's a kid. And I think his relationship with Martha in this movie, and particularly on rewatch, his relationship with Martha to me is even stronger than his relationship with Jonathan, which has never been the case in any Superman iteration that I've seen. But his relationship with her is actually stronger, in my opinion, because the level of empathy that she shows in kind of guiding him through his issues of dealing with his powers is just incredible. And you kind of see Jonathan in this movie, played by Kevin Costner, in the role of the kind of overly concerned parent, right? Where he loves his son so much, but he's almost too concerned with his son's safety and protecting his son versus...
And let's be clear. One of the things that people have knocked about this is, well, why is he so worried about protecting his son? His son's invulnerable. Safety does not always mean physical safety. It can mean emotional safety. It can mean social safety. I mean, he is worried about his son becoming ostracized, becoming an outcast in a world that will not understand him and will fear him instead. So no, he's not worried about somebody murdering his kid. He's worried about how it will affect him emotionally.
Yes, and as is touched upon later in the movie, Martha says this to him later in the movie, they're worried about him being taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the right thing to do in every situation here would be to tell Clark, go out there and save people and help people. But I think what I've always liked about this movie and still do, and there is one aspect that I will take some umbrage with that I can understand the criticism of, but I'll get to that in a second. But I love the fact that the movie doesn't give you easy answers for any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because the right thing to do is for Clark to go help people. The right thing to do is for Clark to use his powers for good. We all know that. However, think of it if it's your kid. Think of it if it's different if you're a parent of a child, that your concern over any I've not had kids, so you can speak more to this than I can, Nick. I'm making assumptions, but my understanding has always been that when you have a kid, it does change you. and that your number one priority is the protection of your child, right? The that that takes over anything else, over anybody else's safety or anybody else's comfort. Your number one is your kid, and it's always going to be your kid. And so I love the fact that this movie presents two real parents that are feeling, you know, feeling the things that real parents would feel.
Absolutely. You know, that's the thing, is the entire Superman, like the classic version of Superman that's kind of portrayed in those Donner movies that people love so much, is kind of this unattainable version for me, right down to the Kents themselves, who are nothing, to me anyway, are just kind of caricatures more than they are characters themselves. And that is not the case in this movie. There, like you said, no easy answers for any of the characters here. It's not a straight line from rocket ship to adult grown Superman. And I think that's why, for me, honestly, this is my favorite modern interpretation of Superman that I've seen, having not, again, having not read a ton of Superman comics in my time. This is a take I can sink my teeth into and kind of latch onto and get it in a way that I don't really get a more classic interpretation of the character.
And this is the one scene, the one bit of dialogue that I don't like in the, because I don't like when Clark says, "What was I supposed to let them do?" And I do like the hesitation from Jonathan, but, and even when he says maybe, but I feel like Jonathan probably should have then said, "No, no, not that." But, you know, and then kind of made his point after that. But instead, it kind of seems like he's still trying to justify letting those kids die, which I don't like.
Right.
But at the same time, to my previous point, the overall point of that scene, the overall tenor of that scene, I love, because I think that's real. I think that's real parent-child interaction. You know, like that's the, because he doesn't know. Jonathan doesn't know either. He's had years of experience and he's a good man, but he doesn't know what the right thing to do is either. But like I said, his top concern is Clark's safety, his son's safety, and preserving what they have. And again, I would rewrite that just a little bit and have him hesitate and then say, "No, you weren't supposed to let them die, Clark." But, and then explain to him why it's important that he doesn't show himself and that he doesn't expose his powers. But again, their relationship here, and you see it in this scene. This is the classic scene, Nick, that was in the trailer that won me over about this movie before I had ever seen it.
Me too.
Just the simple line when Clark says, "Why can't I just be your son?" And he says, "You are my son, Clark." And that's just such a great scene. It's still an emotional scene for me. It's still a powerful scene. Packs a punch to this day. And Kevin Costner, by the way, his take on Jonathan Kent owes a lot to John Schneider's take on Jonathan Kent in Smallville, because that was very much a different Jonathan Kent than we had seen for the most part in the comics to that point. He was usually portrayed as older, usually portrayed as a little bit fat, you know, kind of an old, kindly farmer. And Schneider added a little bit of a, you know, a Jonathan Kent who is a good man and usually makes the right choices and is the moral center for Clark, but also makes mistakes. And certainly that's the case here with this version of Jonathan.
Right.
And all of the parent-child stuff in this movie is great. And all of the young Clark stuff is great. Whether he's, and I apologize to the listeners that I don't have it pulled up in front of me here, but the child actor is really, really good. And even the teen actor is really, really good.
Every version of Clark in this movie is really, really good. And we haven't spent a ton of time talking about him because he hasn't been on screen that much, but I'm sure we will get to Henry Cavill at some point.
Yeah, in fact, why not right now, because we're about to be introduced to him here for the first real substantive scene outside of the rescue where he's going to get some, you know, human moments here, which is in a nice kind of throwback to Superman 2 in the bar scene that plays out over the course of that movie where he's confronted by bully truck drivers who try to piss him off in that movie. Here he has another bully truck driver that shows up. And every fiber of him, you can tell, wants to just shove this guy through a wall. And he's having to hold it in. And who can't relate to that, Nick? Working as we do in our daily lives at our daily jobs, don't we just feel sometimes like we wish we just push certain people through a wall?
Yes, absolutely. That's an accurate statement if there ever was one. But unfortunately, we do not have Kryptonian power, so we can't go outside and mangle their automobile around a telephone pole or whatever.
Yes. That's a great moment here. The little bit of revenge he gets, this version of Clark gets by mangling the semi truck, as the Christopher Reeve version got it by sliding the biker across the bar. But yeah, really good stuff here. And Henry Cavill, who, did you know him before this movie,
no,
Nick? Because I don't think that I had seen him in anything before this.
I know he was on The Tudors, but other than that, I don't know anything else about him.
That's what people call us after we eat at Things and Wings in Dothan.
Oh. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, so this was my first real exposure
kind
to
of,
Henry Cavill.
Kind of an Incredible Hulk take on Superman here, with like him just wandering the earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting take. It's different than anything I'm familiar with, so I can see how it might rub some traditionalists the wrong way.
You halfway expect Stewie to pop up and say, "Play the sad walking away song from The Incredible Hulk." But that never happens, obviously. Only in the deleted scenes on the director's cut. Speaking of which, hashtag release the Snyder cut, Nick.
For Justice League? Absolutely. Let's do that.
Yep.
It can't be any worse than the Justice League movie we got. Actually, it probably could be, but, you know.
I was going to say, we've seen worse. And we've seen worse in the DCEU.
Yeah, but that was David Ayer's fault.
Allegedly. Quite frankly. Now, Henry Cavill does a phenomenal job in this movie of portraying the young, struggling Clark Kent in particular. Unfortunately, we don't get to see him as, quote, Superman a lot in this movie. Mm. So that was supposed to come in a sequel that never happened, because we got Batman versus Superman instead.
Mm.
But we can't judge based on the future. We can only judge on what we have here. And yes, it's true that we don't see him being Superman that much, but this is a different version that they're kind of building from the ground up. And he's a damn good Clark Kent, in my opinion. He plays the vulnerable, the sort of wavering back and forth on what to do. I think to the scene at the church in this film where he goes there as he's unsure what to do when Zod is threatening the earth if he doesn't turn himself in. And he's a guy who, I've talked about my favorite iterations of Superman having this in common, that Superman doesn't necessarily always do the right, he doesn't necessarily make the right choice every time, but he tries. He's always trying to do the right thing. He never acts out of malice. He never acts out of hatred for anybody. And what I like about this is a guy who is just genuinely doesn't know what the right thing to do is, because of how he was raised, because of his heritage, all these other things conflicting with one another. He doesn't know what the right thing to do is. And I think Cavill does an excellent job of portraying that in this movie. And when it needs to get physical, he can handle that as well.
Absolutely. I would certainly agree. He does a great job. You know, you say that there's not really an opportunity for him to be Superman a lot, but when he is Superman, like you said, he has the physical, has the physicality for the mm-hmm. role, does a good job in the action sequences. And then even there's a little scene near the end of the film where he, where he like kind of gently admonishes this general for trying to have surveillance put on him. And it's something that I kind of read or viewed through the lens of like, that's a more classic Superman. So it really mm-hmm. does bring home the idea
Agreed.
Of him learning to be Superman throughout this film, which is what another thing that I think people get wrong. It's not a Superman film. It's a learning to be Superman film.
Yes, absolutely. It's Superman with training wheels.
Right.
And at the end of this movie, how it sets up for a sequel is so brilliant. It's so well, like it still pisses me off to this day of all the decisions that were made in the DCEU. The one that still pisses me off the most is that they did not do a sequel to this movie, and because they had to shoehorn Batman into it.
Because they were in a hurry.
Batman versus Superman could have been a good movie if they had built to it.
If they had done another Superman movie and a solo Batman movie first, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Because the story that movie tells only works if you get a movie before it of him being Superman, of him being the Superman that we know and love, the Superman who's been around long enough to earn the public's trust, and then for the public to turn around and start doubting him again.
Right.
That's the only way that story works. And unfortunately, but we're not here to talk about the future of the DCEU. We want to talk about this movie and what works in this movie. And I totally agree. That scene sets you up in such a wonderful way of this smiling op. Because that was the other. Remember when this movie came out and the big criticism people had about it is he doesn't smile. He doesn't smile enough. And the movie kind of ends with him smiling. Mm-hmm. He smiles at the Daily Planet. He smiles at the general. He's now Superman. He's comfortable in his skin for the first time really in his entire life. He knows who he is. He knows what his mission is. And I think for me, that's one of the reasons that this works. Coming from a longtime Superman fan, that's one of the reasons this movie works for me. Is it does build to that. It doesn't ignore it, but it shows us that process, and it gives you a Superman that I think is more identifiable in the early years. Something closer to what I read in the comics when I was growing up. Something closer to what I saw on Lois and Clark or Smallville than what we would expect from the Donner movies or what we would expect from the Silver Age. And that's no knock on the Donner movies. I like those movies, but different time, and it's a different character. I didn't grow up with that character in the comics. I grew up with a Superman who did struggle. So that's what I appreciate about this one.
Absolutely. Could have said it better myself. Another character that we're getting introduced or have just been introduced to for the first time is Amy Adams, Lois Lane. You know, I know this is another opinion that I'm probably in the minority on, but I love this take on Lois. I thought she had the right amount of feistiness. I thought they had actual intriguing things for her to do in the movie rather than just standing by the way Margot Kidder kind of did a lot of the time, in my opinion. And not to mention, she's an infinitely better actress than fucking Kate Bosworth. So,
oh, Lord.
Cinematically,
Kate Bosworth is easily the worst Lois Lane there's ever been. It's not even close.
Cinematically, this is my favorite Lois Lane.
Cinematically, I would agree, which is a controversial opinion because people love the Margot Kidder version. Mm-hmm. And I don't hate the Margot Kidder version. I like the Margot Kidder version for what it was, what Lois was. But this is much closer to my kind of ideal Lois. Right. Now, Margot had, you know, that style of Lois down, but this is a more human take, I think, on Lois. Margot Kidder's Lois was very rough around the edges. A lot of Loises are like that. Lois should always be a little bit rough around the edges, but maybe veered a little bit too much on that side. And in this one, I think it's much more clear and apparent why Superman would be madly in love with her at a certain point, because she is a fully rounded human being. She's
right.
She is feisty. She is self-inspired. She's resilient, but she's also caring and has... and she can discern between the right and the wrong thing, which you see when she actually decides to sit on the Superman story. When she tracks him, does all this work, tracks him down, and even accepts her 2-week, or then what turns into a 3-week suspension from the planet, because Daily Planet, ooh, that is, not the planet
that's,
Earth.
That's a pretty awesome. That's one of the most inventive uses of the heat vision I've seen. Still love that scene.
Cauterizing the wound, yes. And so Lois in this movie takes a 2-week suspension, or what turns into a 3-week suspension without pay from her employer, mm-hmm, because it's the right thing to do after she taught Clark and his mom. So I love this take on Lois. I really do. Is it my favorite take on the character? No. I think I would lean towards Terry Hatcher or Erica Durant for their iterations of the character. But I would put Amy Adams right behind there with Noel Neal or whoever as right in that next batch of Loises. She joins Lois is another character that has been played by so many great actresses over the years and who have done great jobs, that I think other than Kate Bosworth, everybody has at least been adequate. And I too would put her ahead of Margot Kidder for me. I really like this version of Lois. And it's different too, because it's kind of the John Byrne, again, redheaded Lois that is different from any of the other that we've traditionally seen as a brunette in the comics and other media. So that's good. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, that her chemistry is really good with Cavill too. That helps. If they didn't have chemistry, the movie wouldn't work, because that's sort of the central love story, the central connection between these characters. But pretty much instantaneously, they have good chemistry here. And she's a good actress, does a good job. Also good in this movie is Christopher Maloney from Law & Order SVU. Playing I forget his name, but playing a government operative here, and has a pretty interesting character arc over the course of the movie, Nick.
Yeah, he kind of grows from being skeptical and distrusting of Superman.
Sort of like
and
there was the a guy on the
kind
old,
of embracing them
the old
and
blog of Doom.
Ultimately,
actually,
like,
might actually
meeting his end
back when it's still
in a
on
noble
Scott
fashion.
Keith's and wrestling board. We're really getting into the weeds here on this. But
here we get Lawrence Fishburne as Perry White
on SmackDown.
The internet loves calling.
This guy was known. His name was M. Roberts. And Black Lesnar. Yes, that was it. This was the same guy that had such inventive nicknames as Blandy Borton. What else did he have? That was our good buddy Tripp that had Botchtista and Has-Been. They might have been, actually. Has-Been Kid. Has-Been Kid.
Perry Black Y2 back then, jerk. Because get it? His last name is White, and now he's a black man.
And then my favorite, Vince McIdiot.
Oh, Black Lesnar.
Yeah. What other good ones did Tripp have? There was the immortal Stephanie McSuck.
Botchtista.
Vince McIdiot. Well,
yeah, but it might as well.
Others that I can't.
Are you sure
here.
They weren't the same person?
He was truly a work
given
of art.
Given the inventiveness
this was a,
being displayed
for those that
here?
Aren't in the know, this was a gentleman who used to attend wrestling pay-per-view events at Hooters, which was the only place that you could gather in our town of Dothan to watch wrestling events once upon a time. And this is a man whose observations were so, I guess, legendary that he ended up somehow finding health, a male, banned from Hooters for life. In any event, back to this movie. Yes. One thing that I really appreciate about Perry White in this movie and Lawrence Fishburne's portrayal of him, very, 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 very few comic book movies. Few movies, but few comic book movies in particular that have ever had a remotely, I mean, within the realm of reality version of actual newspaper journalism.
Yes.
In that this is the first time that I can recall a newspaper editor in a comic book movie actually showing judgment and discernment about a story.
Yes, it's pretty remarkable. Like, you know, it's not perfect, like you say, but it's much closer than anything we've ever gotten before.
Yeah, Lois, we can't run this story. Why? We might have hallucinated. There's no facts. There's no corroborating evidence. But I don't understand, Perry. I saw it. I know what I saw. Come on. I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Can't run it. If it was on Daredevil, it would have been on the front page of the Daily Planet as an op-ed.
If it were Superman Returns, it would be the same way.
Yes. Yep, Superman Returns. Pretty much any Spider-Man, pretty much any version of newspaper journalism that we've seen in superhero comics.
Must there be a Superman? Entire front page is one editorial with no art and just a giant, like,
no art,
250
giant
point headline.
A giant block of 1800 style text.
Yes.
Newspapers for like 1870.
Yes.
Oh boy. Yeah. So Russell Crowe as Jor-El is a badass, and Jor-El are not things that I'd ever associated in my mind, but something about Russell Crowe just lends an element of badassery to whoever he plays. And that's no exception here. He's by leaps and bounds the best Jor-El there's ever been. Sorry, Marlon Brando fans. This is the best Jor-El that we've ever gotten. This is maybe what Jor-El could have been if Brando was actually invested in the role. But this is now the definitive for me Jor-El, other than the headdress wearing Jor-El from John Byrne's Man of Steel. But yes, this is an awesome version of Jor-El, and this sort of, as he puts it, shadow of himself who communicates with Clark here. These are good scenes. And, you know, right, they kind of tease us when he gets the suit, but then right when he gets the suit, which is a decision that, by the way, that informs the rest of the movie, including a key moment that we have to discuss. He gets no training as Superman.
Nope.
He gets the suit, and pretty much as soon as he gets the suit, alien invasion.
Yep.
And he is thrust into, on his first day of work, an impossible scenario, taking on people just as or more powerful than him, who have much more experience than him, who know what they're doing, who are aiming to kill him and everyone that he loves. He's put in an unwinnable and untenable position because this is his first day on the job. And I think a lot of people lose track of that because of the length of the film. a lot of people lose track of the fact that this is his first day at work. They think of it as he's Superman. He should always find a way. But I like, again, that there's no easy decisions here. There's no easy choices to anything in this movie. And that's ultimately the one that we have to talk about, the breaking of the neck at the end of this movie. Everyone that's seen this movie knows what we're referring to. It's a scene at the end of the movie. We're not going to say exactly how it happens. There's no point in describing the entire scene. But basically, it ends up with Superman making the split-second decision to kill his enemy. And that set off a firestorm in the comic community that still rages to this day. Superman doesn't kill. It's a hard and fast rule. Superman does not kill. He always finds another way. The, you know, people will always reach, you know, share the scene from All-Star Superman where he says there's always a way. And that's sort of a long time, you know, for the last maybe 40, 50 years of Superman has always been an aspect of his character that has been broken on occasion, by the way.
I was about to say, there, it's not like it's without precedent in the comics.
No, it is not without precedent. And those moments have been met with controversy in the comics as well from certain people. I would argue that making a hard and fast rule for any literary character that can never be broken under any circumstances, I think it's okay to have that in principle. But I think that if you're never going to allow yourself to explore that territory in any way, that is inherently limiting and unnecessary. And also does nothing to dispel the notion that Superman is an unrelatable character that some people have. Because, and people say the same thing about Batman. Well, Batman doesn't kill, and he doesn't, and he shouldn't. And Superman doesn't, and shouldn't. But does that mean you can't tell a story where Batman goes over the line? Does that mean you can't tell a story where Superman goes over the line, where Batman makes a mistake early? And why? That's another thing. Why does Batman have a hard and fast rule of no killing? What is it that instills that in him? Same thing with Superman. What is it about his life experience that gives Superman the idea, I cannot harm life. I cannot let anyone die.
How can anyone tell me that this movie is joyless, by the way? Like, he is clearly having fun here. Like,
what, he's flying around. He crashes on his first attempt to fly.
I understand he's not saving kittens out of trees and helping old ladies across the street and whatnot. But like, it's not like he's not enjoying himself from time to time. Come on, you know.
I love, this is something they used in all the DCEU movies, but I love that supersonic effect.
Oh, of him like putting his. Oh, you're talking about when he's flying through the air. I was thinking of the vibration effect when he kind of is doing the classic Superman pose and like the ground is vibrating before he takes off. That was kind of cool.
That's cool. But I've always loved this in the movies when he hits the speed of sound and it just has that boom.
Yep.
The sound editing in this movie in general is excellent. Mm-hmm. And here's your obligatory
homage.
Richard Donner homage.
Yep.
And it's tastefully done.
Yes.
So, yeah, the usage of the powers, the usage of, you know, him smiling in this scene and having fun, there is a sense of joy to this. Plus, I just have joy in watching these characters interact with each other. We talked about that before. But to finish off my point about the killing thing, this movie establishes this as a sort of landmark moment, a linchpin moment for Superman where he makes this decision and he instantly regrets it. And you can see it on his face that it hurts him to have had to do this. Mm-hmm. And they make it clear in the movie that he had to do this.
Yes.
And it makes sense to me that from that moment on, you can build in a sequel. He's never going to do that again. He's never going to be put in that situation again.
And again, if they had taken the time to make a sequel to truly follow up on that decision, I feel like context would have ultimately been kinder to it for a lot of people, but, you know, again, hindsight, you can't account for what happened after this.
Yes, and I can admit I had a reaction to a couple episodes ago we were talking about Final Crisis. It never sat well with me, Batman picking up a gun and shooting it at Darkseid. But I think the difference is that that's a mature Batman who we've been established to believe as we talked about with Grant Morrison's Batman, always has the right answer for everything and never makes a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's a young Clark Kent who makes a mistake, does something that he will regret later on, and is put in a situation, by the way, that in all reality just makes sense. We've seen it in the MCU. How many villains have died in the MCU, Nick?
Tons. Most of them. The vast majority.
Absolutely. And yet it's never that big a deal, but for some reason, if it's super... And it was very violent. I will grant you that. He broke his neck. That's pretty violent for Superman. And so, yes, there are ways to write yourself out of that in the script process, but I kind of like the fact that they embraced it. Maybe not liked, as it's liked a strong term, but I don't hate it, and I still don't hate it. I think at the time it shocked me, and it left me feeling weird, but I think that was the goal, and that was the idea, because that's exactly what it does to Clark. And no, they don't have a scene where it kind of beats you over the head with him sitting there talking about it, but you can see it on his face, the agony that he's in. It reminds me, actually, oddly enough, that scene of Enter the Dragon when Bruce – I know you haven't seen the movie, but when Bruce Lee kills the guy that killed his sister years ago, he jumps up. He's beating him in the fight, and he has him completely beaten, and then he makes the decision to jump up and break his neck. And when he does, there's this look of just anguish and torture on his face as he does it, and that's kind of what this reminded me of. Now, here's one scene that – I will say on the rewatch, when I rewatched the movie, there had to be a better way to do the Jonathan death scene, in my opinion. What do you think of this, Nick? Absolutely. Car accident to kind of play off the bus incident earlier. There were any number of situations they could have done.
Yeah, this is the one that I can kind of like, you know, I can kind of go with people on. I can go with them on the execution. The idea of it,
it's still not clear. That opposed and to the idea of like Jonathan, there's no reason here for Jonathan
Clark to kind of stand to by and
go in there himself,
takes him over. Like, but you could have done that with Mugger. No, you could have done that with like Clark, any right, number of things car. Rather than.
But if they were in another situation, I see it. Unless I guess Jonathan's thought is, well, if that something like that happens. When yeah. his car so they, flies onto him, people will see.
Yeah, the execution powers. Is poor. The idea so of it, makes sense I think, is fine.
But
for me,
yeah, there just had to be a better way to execute this scene. But I do agree that Jonathan, the ultimate, you know, sacrifice of the parent. I like that better than him just dying of a heart attack. Even though that worked in the first movie to show, because the point of that was to show that Superman, for all his powers, couldn't save, mm-hmm. can't stop everything. He can't play God, basically. And so I do appreciate that too,
right.
But I like the idea of Jonathan caring so much about his son's safety and well-being that he sacrifices his own life to preserve it. But again, I don't like this. I don't like him just getting swept up in a tornado. Good acting from Cavill.
Yeah, absolutely.
Complete. I would suggest that if I were like George Lucas and could go back and re-edit this movie, I would add in, after he says dad, I would keep the scene there for a moment, and then I would have him go, no!
The other aspect of the ending that we kind of need to talk about is that closing action sequence, and on a couple of different levels. One, because we discussed how big, over-the-top action had not really been done in a Superman movie to this point, so we kind of need to talk about it like from the standpoint of action itself. And the other controversy around this film, Superman doesn't stop in the middle of the fight with Zod to save anyone, except when it comes to breaking his neck where he's saving people, and you bitched about that too.
Yes, I've kind of plowed over this ground so many times with people on the internet about this movie of... I think it goes back to his first day on the job.
Right.
Doesn't know to take Zod out of civilization. He doesn't know, and he couldn't if he wanted to, because Zod's better than him.
Yes.
Zod has years of experience and has been trained to be a warrior. Clark doesn't have that. Clark's been a fisherman and a construction worker and an Indian chief.
And a hobo.
And all this other stuff. And has been writing disco songs. You know, that's what he's been doing. He hasn't been warring to preserve his planet. So he's at a disadvantage anyway against a superior warrior on the first day of his job, basically, where he doesn't know what he's doing, doesn't know where he is, doesn't know how to go save people while he's got a guy that's going to kill him in a fight. It just makes sense to me. Here's my deal about the fight scene, that climactic fight scene. I love it in so many ways. I actually think the best fight scene in this movie is the one that takes place sort of midway through the film, the Smallville fight scene.
Yeah, I would. I think I still like the closing one better, but it's the Smallville one is very good as well. The closing one is like, you know,
Yep, and they give us the full litany of Superman powers. Yeah. Yep. Since as the 8-year-old kid that read The Death of Superman, I am never not going to mark out for the windows shattering when Superman punches people. I am never not going to mark out at that. And the other aspect, it's almost become a cliche shot on Supergirl now, but the shot of their heat vision, like, hitting each other, you know?
It is very clear that it sets out to answer that criticism of Superman Returns. It's like, you are not going to complain about a lack of action in this film. And it perhaps...
Yeah.
Yes, and maybe it goes too far, but I would argue, for my taste anyway, at that point, I would rather them have gone too far than not gone far enough. And thus, I appreciated it, and still appreciate it.
Yeah, it's...
Yes.
It's so
and
good.
It was awesome.
The only criticism I have of it, and I said this
airborne
when I
punches
the
as they're pummeling
I do think
each other,
the action scene lasts too long.
Because awesome.
I think the movie actually could have been a little bit shorter, or they could have added a little bit more towards the end of the film of the Daily Planet stuff.
Yes.
Or whatever. Because... There's
Zod
a
get to hit him with the
in this action scene.
Clark goes
it's
to
who, awesome.
Zod
it's so spectacular.
The
and then there's a certain part
and Clark
where
melts the beam down
a little
slag,
bit,
like in
and
the
it kind of drags
it flying through the air. Like just good stuff like that, man.
On maybe 2 to 3 minutes longer than I think it should have, but overall, excellent action and easily the most impressive action that we've seen in a Superman movie. And Zack Snyder really outdoes himself with showing us the range of his powers. Again, to me, a little bit overkill in terms of how long it lasts, but to your point, a great counteract to what we had gotten in pretty much all of the movies prior.
Do you remember how
exception of Superman 2.
How convinced people were that this chick was Carol Ferris, by the way?
Yes.
Like, because I think her last name was Ferris, spelled a different way, and everyone was convinced that it was going to wind up being Carol Ferris, and they were going to do a Green Lantern movie spinning out of this. And
this
that was the mistake on their part. They were assuming there was going to be another Green Lantern movie.
No, we've learned by this point there will never be another Green Lantern movie.
Nope.
There will be one that will be in development
for
approximately 35 years.
Yes.
But... Yeah, this version of Emil Hamilton, by the way, is very smug. Like the general comes in, could it be a comet? Actually, a comet doesn't redirect itself, okay?
Why does he sound like Van Driessen?
Because men have feelings, too. Can I share mine with you?
We got a brief glimpse there at Jenny Olsen a moment ago.
Not to be confused with Jimmy Olsen, the journalist who gets killed... Yes. That's another podcast, which you can find right here in our archives on PTB and Pop. But yeah, so pretty much wrapping this up, we really like this movie. I think that's obvious from the way we talk about it. We're aware of all the arguments against it. We just don't agree with them. The vast majority of them, anyway. I think I've pointed out a few things that I, you know, can nitpick about the movie that aren't...
The photographer who gets killed in the opening, like, moments of Batman v Superman.
That aren't perfect. I don't think it's a perfect movie by any means.
But we feel they are nitpicks and not, like... There are people who feel this movie has major, unavoidable, can't get around them, fundamental flaws. And I do not see a single one of those.
No, there's nothing in this movie that breaks it for me. Including the broken neck. I really enjoy this. I think it's one of the best takes on Superman that there has been. And certainly on the big screen, not that there's a lot of competition, but I think it more than holds its weight for what it's trying to do. Is it going to be as iconic as the original Superman film? No. Is it my favorite Superman film? I still probably lean Superman 2, but I actually like this better than I like the original Superman movie, which is heresy in many circles, I know. And I acknowledge that it's probably not as perfect a film as that one was, but I guess this is more of the Superman that I want to see going forward, more of the Superman mythos that I want to see. And for me, the biggest problem with this movie is that it didn't get a sequel.
So. I agree with pretty much everything you just said, except for me, I'll say this is far and away my favorite Superman movie that I've ever seen. I like the original well enough. I am not a big fan of Superman 2, as you and I have discussed times over the years. So for me, this is easily the best, most intriguing, most relatable version of the character that I've ever seen put on film. And I'm like you, I think it's a shame this never got a sequel.
Yep. And I think it also goes to, in my opinion, to further my theory that Zack Snyder is okay if he has other people writing and developing the story without him.
Right.
But all that being said, we're going to wrap this thing up. Obviously, we're recommending people, if you haven't seen this movie, go see it. Give us your thoughts on it. You can tweet us at gphillips865tu, at nickduke87. If you want to be angry at us, you can tweet us at jrsbbq. Mm-hmm. You can also shoot us emails at gregp@playspeednation.com, nickd@playspeednation.com. But to be honest with you, we're probably not going to check those. And
also, you can, if you really love the movie, be sure to go to the PlaySpeedNation Comics Facebook page and leave a comment there and tag our good friend Aaron George in your comment.
Yes. And also our good friend, the manager, Todd Weber, who's That's a big true. Fan of this one, I know. Mm-hmm. So we do welcome feedback. Join Place to Be Nation Comics. You can find it on Facebook, PTBN Comics on Twitter, and let's see, anywhere else where they can give us feedback. That's pretty much it. We're not on the gram yet, as the kids say.
No.
Nor does anyone want us there, based on our physical appearance.
No.
But in any event, we're going to take a commercial break, and when we come back, we've got reading, we've got watching, we've got the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
PlaySpeed Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here, and we want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaySpeedNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PlaySpeed Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlaySpeedNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaySpeedNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySpeedNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome
back to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I, of course, am Greg Phillips, still joined by Nick Duke. Hope you enjoyed our look at Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex. And we are here to start things off in our second half with the segment where we tell you what we have been reading and what we have been watching from the comic book world in the last week. It's a segment that we call
reading and watching. So, Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
Exactly the same, although I am going to start reading for next week's episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Mm-hmm. We're excited about that.
We'll be reviewing the first four issues, the first story arc of the WWE comic from Boom Studios. I believe it's Boom Studios, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so as well.
That'll be good. Good. And thus, we should then turn away from reading onto watching. Now, before we get started on our usual CW shows, I neglected to mention last week that I watched another comic book property. Thanks to the DC Universe app, I was able to watch the recently released Reign of the Superman animated film. This is the follow-up to the excellent Death of Superman animated film, which I believe I called, Nick, the best DC animated film since they started this new universe of films, so to speak, based on the new 52 versions of these characters. And I got to say, overall, my response to the movie, really good. I don't think that it's as good as Death of Superman was. I'll say that right out of the gates. I thought that some of the changes they made in this movie bothered me in ways that they didn't bother me in Death of Superman. However, overall, very, very good. I thought the voice acting was really good in this one. Everyone seemed, if anything, more assured in their roles, especially Rainn Wilson as Lex Luthor, who was my one real issue with Death of Superman. I did not like his take on Lex. It feels like maybe I'm more comfortable with him, but I think he's also more comfortable in the role in this one and kind of settles into a zone on Lex that, while it's never going to be my preferred take on the character, is certainly more palatable than what I got in Death. So I liked all the voice acting here. Hank Henshaw is excellent in the movie. Their version of Hank Henshaw is excellent. And I even liked the way, to a degree, that, you know, if they were going to change the original story, I do like how they managed to incorporate a longtime DC villain into the movie. And it's not the one that you may remember from the comics who helps out Hank Henshaw. It's another one that actually ties into the animated movie universe. So I appreciated all of that stuff. All of the sort of four Supermen that are the anchor of this movie were really good. The Eradicator was well done. John Henry Irons, probably the least interesting of the four in the movie, but he was well done as well. And the real standout of this movie was Superboy, Connor Kent, or Kon-El, as he is in this one. He to me, was the standout of the movie. He was outstanding. Lois Lane is great in this movie, as she was in Death. She and Connor are kind of the drivers of the movie in a lot of ways, the audience viewpoint at times. Of course, Henshaw's there, and he's great. I really liked there's a lot to like about this movie. It didn't move me the way that Death did. But to be honest, even in the comics, Rain didn't move me the same way that Death did. I just really enjoyed it as a story. And I really enjoyed this one, too. I think people will dig it if they watch it back-to-back with Death. I'm planning on doing that at some point soon, kind of viewing them together and seeing how the experience is. But another successful movie for DC Animation, hopefully heading, giving us some momentum for Batman Hush later this year, Nick.
Glad to hear it. I'll probably check these out at some point, but glad to hear that you enjoyed them.
Well, let's get cracking on the C-dubs. We did not have... actually, we did have Supergirl, and
nope,
I haven't watched it.
We did not.
We didn't?
Nope.
Another week with no Supergirl?
Yep.
Why?
Why? Because CW.
Well, if anything, this gets me off the hook. Gives me time to catch up on the one that I'm behind on. Obviously, we're very behind on Black Lightning. I'm going to try to catch up on that at some point, because I really want to. The previews are great, but I'm just behind right now. However, did watch Arrow on Monday night, and it was the 150th episode, Nick. And this gave us a very bold and different version of Arrow, a different style of episode. It was a shot in, at least mostly shot, in a documentary style.
Yes.
And was presented even with at the beginning as if you were watching a documentary film, complete with the Warner Brothers logo at the beginning, and kind of makes you feel like you're settling in to watch a documentary about the Star City vigilantes, and in particular the Arrow, the Green Arrow, Oliver Queen, and what his actions have led to over the years. And because of the approach this episode takes, with a documentary crew following Oliver Queen and his supporting cast around, it really changes the flavor of the episode a lot. And it also allows us to see interview sequences that this director had supposedly shot with characters dating back to 2014, which means we get Detective Lance back again, an interview with him from what would have been, I think, season 2 or 3 of the show. We get an interview with Sin, now going by Cindy, who people may remember from seasons 2 and 3 of the show. She was, or maybe it was 3, where she was like, she was closely affiliated with Sarah, if you remember. Sarah was kind of her guardian angel of sorts. And we get an interview with her, and we learn that she's not as fond of, that she's kind of doubting a little bit of the vigilante lifestyle, even though she appreciates what they did for her. Who are some of the other ones that we encountered during the episode, Nick, that we haven't seen in a while?
Oh, Ragman.
Yeah, Ragman. Totally forgot about him. Mm-hmm. That's been kind of a lingering question that people have had, is what's he been up to? And we find out that he gave up wearing a mask and being Ragman, but he's still helping people. And, of course, we also get a plot about a character who is tied into Oliver's past. Stop me if you've heard this before. Who, as a result of the admission by Oliver to the prison psychologist that his father murdered his bodyguard on the raft all those years ago, that guy's son has gone crazy and is now trying to hunt down vigilantes and collect their masks. And so I thought that was a great little plot to have in here. We get an outstanding vintage Arrow fight scene that is shot handheld documentary style in a hallway scene. And it's, I don't know how many takes they needed to get it, but it was beautiful. It was beautiful to watch. Great fight scene. And just across the board, it's an excellent episode, I thought, of Arrow. The flash forward at the end was exciting. I'm really digging that future storyline, as we talked about. The return of William in this episode we got, mm-hmm. who we haven't seen really all season, in his child version anyway. I really appreciated that. The continued development of Zoe as a character that we know is going to play a role in the future. And even some involvement from Emiko here. So overall, Nick, I thought this was a fantastic episode.
It was a damn good episode of Arrow, but it had an ending that I think was really lazy and kind of cheapens all last
Agreed. Yep.
Last season, when we had the entirety of Team Arrow being deputized by the Star City Police Department, virtually getting around, essentially getting around the anti-vigilante laws that were put into place during last season as a result of Oliver turning himself in. And to me, it's kind of lazy on the part of the writers and kind of defeats the purpose of what the journey has been to this point. It just kind of feels like a magic reset button that I would argue the show didn't really need. I don't really have any interest in Wild Dog and Curtis and Dinah running around out there in the streets with Ollie again. I have enjoyed a more Ollie-centric approach to the on-the-street aspect of the show. So we'll see where things go from here. I've already heard at least one positive thing coming out of this week that we'll talk about on next week's show.
Yes. I agree with that. I thought the same thing. I actually rolled my eyes when that happened because, I've made it clear I don't think there needs to be necessarily a Team Arrow, at least in the way that the show has sort of built it in. I think there will be, clearly, regardless of that. And it can work. It worked last year to a degree, but I agree. I like the show when it focuses more on Ollie. But that being said, still a really good episode and excited about the same thing that I think you're excited about on this week's episode. So, moving on from that, Flash, Tuesday night.
Oh.
Much of the same story, in my opinion, from Arrow. An outstanding episode that did have one negative aspect to it. But it's the same negative aspect that
every
we've been talking
about. It's the same negative aspect that's been on this show the entire season. Chris Klein trying to be missing as Cicada is just painful to watch.
And I would say that it's laughable, but I can't even bring myself to laugh at it.
No, it's just eye-rolling. It induces eye-rolls. It is like watching...
He doesn't even talk like a human being. He does not talk like any person who has ever lived.
It is like watching a Michael Pena Ant-Man scene. It hurts to watch and just causes
Lord,
you to roll
get
your
get the
eyes.
Hell out of here with that. Get the fuck out of here with that. Don't compare him to Michael Pena. Michael Pena takes a dump all over him.
Well, whatever they do in their private lives is none of our business, Greg.
He's sitting at the table. Tell me, Iris. He talks like the Undertaker cutting one of those bad, long, rambling promos from 1999 on Raw, talking about going into the desert. You know, when we rode our bikes into the desert and I saw the Big Show out there. I can't even do it. My throat's hurting now. Yeah, it was.
All that being said, the rest of the episode was great. Whether it was an actual intriguing take on Goldface, which I never thought I would see. Goldface.
Yes, because Al Jordan in those days could not affect the color yellow. So imagine his feelings when a guy named Goldface came along. He had to be hoping it was one of those ironic.
Is a character I encountered a lot during my Green Lantern chronological reading, because as you know, Goldface had an inherent advantage and would just whoop Al Jordan's ass for the majority of whatever story they were telling. He was yellow. The color yellow, yes. And then... Yes, and... And then we get more Thawne this week than we've gotten in some time, and it was awesome. And the Sherlock stuff worked. Everything about this episode worked, except for Cicada.
Yep. I loved Goldface. I thought... Mm-hmm. In fact, I was like, hey, if we got a season of Goldface, I would be better with that than what we're getting with Cicada. He definitely needs to be added to the Rogues if they do ever do a Rogues season. He was great. And another thing that I love, and I will praise it every time they give it to us, Barry having fun being the Flash, or in this case, not being the Flash. That sequence where Barry and Ralph are going through with Rob Zombie music playing, gunning down guys like in a video game, was so much fun. Barry cracking jokes at times during the episode, just being lighthearted and goofy. It was more of that season one Barry that I think the show has gone away from at times over the years. I loved it. I thought it was great. All that stuff was outstanding. Ralph was great. Iris was great. Everybody, well, I say Iris was great when she wasn't having to deal with Chris Klein's atrocious acting. And to be fair to Chris Klein, terrible writing on that character as well. Not interesting. Quite boring. But that being said, really good episode. Rank them for the week. Only two episodes to rank here. I would go... I'm actually going
to
go Flash.
Now, before you try to rank anything, Greg, let me clarify. There are two. So when we're ranking here, you'll have a number one... And a number two, just that. No duplicates of any numbers.
No
skipping of any numbers. It'll be a number one.
I'll have a number
and a
nine
number two.
And a number four.
Well, now I know you like to have extra number nines and number fours whenever you can, based on your MCU rankings last week. But this is just a one and a two. Go ahead.
And a one and a two. I will go Flash and then Arrow.
I will
even
go.
Though I love both of them.
I will go Arrow and then Flash.
Very good. All right. Well, that brings an end to that segment and to Nick's baseless and pointless making fun of me. That
it's
he
not
loves
baseless,
to do.
Pointless perhaps, but baseless, no. It happened. Our loyal listeners know it happened. They heard it happen.
Our loyal listeners. We don't have any loyal listeners.
Again, there might be a couple.
Their loyalty is for sale just as much as ours is.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody came to us right now and offered to write us checks – for say, oh, I don't know, $100 each, but we had to not show any loyalty to our audience, we'd do that in a heartbeat.
We would sit here and call our audience rat bastards for an hour.
That's exactly right. But do you know who isn't a rat bastard?
Who's that?
Aquaman.
Wait a minute.
We're going to get started on a segment that is our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. And I use that Aquaman transition because we're about to start the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown.
And to kick things off on the rundown, we have what I thought was a pretty weird news story that came out this week, Nick, unless you're familiar with Warner Brothers Studios. And that news is that while before we even get an Aquaman sequel, officially, before one has even been put into production necessarily, an Aquaman spinoff has been planned. And this is how successful the movie was. Warner Brothers has already spent planning a spinoff. And you might think to yourself, well, who could they spin off from that movie? Maybe a movie about Mira and her past, right? That could work.
Yeah.
Maybe a movie about Atlan, the king of Atlantis. Mm-hmm. A movie set in Atlantis' past, maybe. That could work. But no. No, the studio instead is working on a spinoff centered on the Trench, the villainous underdwellers that were created by Geoff Johns for his classic, or at least utilized by Geoff Johns for his classic, modern classic Aquaman story, The Trench. The film will reportedly be a horror movie set in the home realm of the Trench and will carry a lower budget. Screenwriters Noah Gardner and Aidan Fitzgerald are writing the script. And this is another key thing. The principal cast of Aquaman is not expected to appear in this movie. Now, not to say, Nick, that necessarily a horror-based Trench movie can't work. But is this not an odd next step project for Warner Brothers?
It's extremely odd. I don't get it. Like, if you wanted to do an Aquaman sequel that was almost entirely focused on the Trench, I would be fine with that.
Sure.
That would be a great opportunity for a story, I think, to further explore that visual dynamic we could see a little bit in Aquaman. But to do a movie about the Trench with characters who don't speak. Like, what are you going to do? Just have, like, some humans accidentally show up in the Trench and be chased by the monsters the entire time?
My assumption is it'll be something like John Carpenter's The Thing, where the Trench will be kind of tormenting a small group of humans or some, like, alien or predator or something where it's a small group of humans and they're sort of being, you know, hunted and stalked by the Trench or haunted by the Trench somehow. But I don't know, but it's weird, man. It's weird unless you understand Warner Brothers and how they are the most reactionary studio that there has ever been.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it comes to their superhero properties.
Yes. Either a project is perceived to be a failure and they burn the entire franchise to the ground and never look at it again, like, oh, I don't know, Green Lantern. Or a project has a modicum of success and you proceed to throw all of your eggs in that basket.
Yes. Now watch what happens, Greg, if Shazam is a big success and then we get spin-off movies featuring each member of the Marvel family in their own standalone movie, even though nobody will want that.
Right. Or here's a better one. Watch what happens if Shazam flops.
Yes.
And suddenly, they pull the plug on all of these spinoff movies and all of these sequels. And suddenly, you get, well, we're going to do the Wonder Woman sequel. We're going to see that to fruition. And we're going to do an Aquaman sequel. Everything else is off the table because Shazam flopped.
Yep.
This is how this studio – by the way, we're not predicting that that will happen. We're just saying that's how this studio works. This is the same studio that will base its marketing campaigns and its future plans around a group of studio executives giving a standing ovation to a preview screening of a movie that doesn't come out for another 6 months. How many times have we read about that, Nick?
Numerous.
That then leads to Green Lantern 2 already in development before the movie even comes out. Or boy, this movie did not do as well as we wanted it to. You know what? We don't want to do a Man of Steel sequel. We need Batman to really take this box office over the top. So we're going to do Batman versus Superman. Oh, and we're going to give the entire keys of the kingdom to Zack Snyder to build our entire universe. Oh, well, wait a minute. Wonder Woman was good, so we can salvage this. But Justice League wasn't good, so the whole thing needs to be torn up. Everybody's gone. So it's they are just incredibly reactionary to everything. And I think this trench thing is another case of throwing all their eggs in one basket, and also, to mix my metaphors here, counting their chickens before they hatch. Because I don't think that there's more of an audience demand for a trench movie than there is for a Green Lantern movie or a Flash movie or a Cyborg movie or a Teen Titans movie. Not an Ezra Miller
movie. I was about to say, don't you wish that evil on me, Ricky Bobby.
In any event, we do have other stories to talk about besides just that one, including one area where DC has been making great decisions, which is on television. With a casting report from the Batwoman pilot that we've been talking about in recent weeks. They have cast their big villain for that pilot episode. The character name is Alice. She is actually the twin sister of Kate Kane in the comics, named Elizabeth Kane, real name, but she goes by Alice. And the woman cast as her is Rachel Skarsten, who has a sort of unusual tie to DC Comics. She actually played the Black Canary on Birds of Prey, the short-lived or short-lived WB series from the early 2000s, much maligned at the time. I've never actually watched it, Nick. Have you?
No, I have not. But
it is on the DC Universe app.
And it's on our schedule, download, I think next year sometime.
Oh, very good. But, yeah, so we've got our villain for the Batwoman pilot. It looks like it's starting to shape up here, Nick.
Yeah, I'm all for this. It's always cool to see CW or you know, Guggenheim and company reach back into the past of DC television and bring some of these actors back, and this is just another example of that. So, good to see that nod, and she ain't bad to look at either, so that's good.
Indeed. Well, from one dominant female hero to another, we go to the world of The Walking Dead and its biggest female protagonist, Michonne. A report has come out from Hollywood Reporter, actually, that Black Panther actress Danai Gurira will be exiting her role as Michonne on AMC's The Walking Dead following a limited return next season. This isn't a real surprise given how good she was in Black Panther. She was one of the breakout stars of that, and will probably be seeing more work in the future for Marvel, in addition to possibly launching her own movie career now. So no big surprise here, but it looks like she's going to be being phased out next season on The Walking Dead. So, we had to report on this. I don't think it's a huge shock, but still, anytime a longtime member of the show like this leaves, it's going to make news. And certainly it does feel like another step in the ending of an era for The Walking Dead.
Yeah, as you know, I haven't been watching the show, so I can't really comment too much on what her current direction is, but it certainly feels like The Walking Dead as we know it is, if not over, coming to an end, and will eventually be something wholly unrecognizable from what the show was originally.
Right. Well, moving on from that, we got a report that I'm actually just now reading the entirety of, but Marvel is fully flexing its partnership with Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
Hulu will be creating 5 new adult-oriented animated series based on Marvel characters. These will be consist of Howard the Duck, Hit Monkey, MODOK, and The Dazzler and Tigra Show, with a 5th series called The Offenders, bringing characters from all 4 series together.
That's pretty good. Yep.
Only Howard the Duck so far has a creative team attached, with your boy, Kevin Smith, attached to it, along with Aqua Teen Hunger Force co-creator Dave Willis developing the series.
Okay, here's a minor question. My understanding was that because the Fox deal has not technically closed yet, they're not allowed to have any active development on any characters that would fall under the purview of Fox, right?
I don't know.
Would Dazzler not be considered an X-Men character?
She would be, yeah.
That's my question.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that, despite everybody, all of us seem to be have been talking about this merger with a lot of certainty on things. I don't think anybody has certainty on how this is all going to work, because certainly this announcement kind of flies in the face of brand new developments. But I guess if these characters are all now under Marvel's purview, I don't know. I really don't know the answer to your question, but I know you were actually hoping that MODOK would get the Kevin Smith treatment, but
yeah, I'm actually of these. I'm most excited about the MODOK show. Like, I don't know, you know, I don't know about its long term, if it can be a multi season thing, but a one season one off MODOK thing sounds kind of awesome to me. I'm all in for this. It's also interesting to note that we all assumed that that Greg has strange noises during his half of the podcast, but
I was getting a Facebook message.
Uh huh. From
good Lord. I'll tell you later.
I'll tell you tomorrow. Anyway, I think we had all assumed that part of the reason that the Netflix shows were being canceled was because of Disney's desire to have all of its Marvel content on Disney Plus. But at the same time, we wondered about, well, how will more adult-themed content work in the confines of Disney Plus? Now, they've said they want to keep it a relatively family-friendly app. Well, here might be a potential window into how, you know, some adult-themed things could get made. Because what we all forget is that Disney owns a 60% ownership stake in Hulu as well. They're essentially going to own two major streaming services. And here, they're saying these animated series are going to be, you know, more themed towards adults. And that could potentially be the landing spot for, you know, some of that content. I know there's even been reports out there that Hulu leadership would potentially be interested in reviving the Netflix shows that have been canceled by Netflix and could potentially be moving back over to Disney's purview. So, interesting on multiple counts, but I think the most interesting thing, the Hulu of it all to me, not necessarily the concept of these shows themselves.
Yes. Quite interesting. Quite interesting all around. And curious to see how it all plays out, obviously. Another Marvel imprint of sorts was the Ultimate Universe, one that is near and dear to the heart of Nicholas Brandenburg Duke. But recently, some more news has come out regarding the Ultimate Universe. This coming from hotshot writer Donnie Cates. He's a hot name in the world of comics right now, a writer of Venom and other titles. I've not read anything from him, but I've heard good things. Well, he has expressed interest in revitalizing Marvel Comics' Ultimate Universe. Okay, I'm looking at this story now, and it's literally just kind of a throwaway comment about...
To be fair, he later followed up and was like, yeah, I actually want this to happen. He commented further on it beyond what's in the Newsarama article.
Well, never mind. Talking about possibly rebooting the Ultimate Universe or revitalizing the Ultimate Universe. I gotta say, Nick, sometimes you just gotta let a sleeping dog lie. And not that I'm saying the idea. I think the idea of the Ultimate Universe is a great one for the modern era. Go ahead, but do it again and do it for a new generation. Don't do – if you're just picking up the Ultimate Universe, so to speak, A, you're marrying yourself to a term that is, you know, rooted in 2000. and you're marrying yourself to another long-running universe, which defeats the entire purpose of the exercise.
Yes, I would say, you know, there are a variety of different... Okay, let's assume this happens, which I don't actually think it's going to happen. Let me be clear. But if it did happen, there are a couple of different routes I could take. Right before Brian Michael Bendis left, he used Spider-Man 2 to reveal that the Ultimate Universe that we had thought was dead had actually continued on. And he gave us a very brief, like, 2-page glimpse at what these characters look like and kind of what their status quo was in the years since Secret Wars. So, in theory, you could have somebody else come along and pick up the ball from there. I don't want that to happen for multiple reasons. One, being exactly what you just said, it defeats the entire idea and spirit of the Ultimate Universe to begin with. The Ultimate Universe launched in 2000. By the time this hit store shelves, you would think you would be pushing, like you said, 20 years of the Ultimate Universe. And it's a continuity that honestly has gotten very convoluted in and of itself. It's just as much of an impediment to new readers as the classic continuity was considered to be for new readers back when the Ultimate Universe was first launched. Not to mention the fact that I kind of only want Brian Michael Bendis to have ever written that incarnation of Peter Parker. I don't really want anybody else to shepherd that character. I'm fine with leaving that character where it is.
Yeah, combine that with, there's...
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to combine that with the fact that arguably the Ultimate Universe's most lasting creation has been taken away from it and given to the main universe in Miles Morales. Like, it just seems like a really weird idea to even possibly bring back that continuity. The other way you could do it is by creating a whole new line of comics that is not bolden to any sort of continuity and just use the Ultimate line as an homage to the idea and the spirit behind the original line, which I would be fine with. But if you're going to do that, it needs to kind of have a shelf life. Like, there's only so many years you can tout an easy entry point for content before years of storytelling become too much to circumnavigate. So it's a difficult prospect. I'm the biggest Ultimate Universe fan you'll find, and I don't know that I want this to happen.
Right, and which is not to say that you can't still tell stories with that universe, but if you're trying to... If your goal, I think they've gotten so far removed from what the goal was of the Ultimate Universe. The goal was to provide an entry point for kids and young people in the early 2000s to encounter a version of the Marvel Universe that they could join from the ground up, that had young characters like them, young characters they could relate to, that were very their era. They don't really have that now. They try to incorporate that idea into the main universe to varying results in both companies. And I think that idea of the Ultimate Universe could very much work today if they would commit to that and kind of... And that doesn't mean that you have to necessarily... You can revisit these Ultimate characters, but I would like to see them use the way that they used the Earth 2 characters in the pre-crisis years of DC, where once a year you'd get the... You know, the team up of the Justice Society and the Justice League. And every now and again, you would have in annuals or whatever, you'd have stories of the Earth 2 Superman, check in on him and what he's doing, or the Earth 2 Batman, check in on him and what he's doing, Huntress and all that stuff. But, and maybe even a series following those people's adventures, but as a line-wide kind of thing, it defeats the purpose, in my opinion, of what you were aiming for with that. So, we'll see where it all turns out. Who knows? But Donnie Cates, I know, is said to be a very good writer. So we'll see where that all develops in the future. But I do think that it's something that Marvel could take advantage of and leverage a chance to introduce new versions of their tried and true characters in a way that, you know, perhaps wouldn't piss off some of the easily pissed off Marvel fans out there.
Yes, I agree.
Well, that's the rundown. We have completed the rundown. And I'm looking over on the corner, Nick, at this vintage 1880s gold pocket watch that I have now.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it, and I can't
I can't help but notice that there's a minute on there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why there's only 1 minute on a gold pocket watch from 1880, but there it is. And so I have no choice but to begin the wrestling minute.
I'm not aware of any wrestling minute.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. I'd like a redo.
Yes, please.
Do I get a blackjack mulligan on that?
Absolutely. You can even have a new blackjack on it.
Ooh. The wrestling minute, folks.
Mm-hmm.
And man, there's so much news going on in the world of wrestling.
News of the Z, of course.
Absolutely. I have not conversed with Raw yet this week or SmackDown. However, lots of news involving All Elite Wrestling. Mm-hmm. They've got their first big card, Double or Nothing. The lineup is set, headlined by Chris Jericho versus Kenny Omega 2. Also featured on the card will be the Young Bucks against the Lucha Bros, assuming that Rey Fénix is not badly injured. And also Pac versus Hangman Page, which I think will be a great match. And yeah, really good card they're putting out there. Cody Rhodes hasn't signed a match yet, but of course there's a lot of rumors lingering out there about the possibility of Dean Ambrose maybe going AEW. So what do you think of this, Nick?
Oh, I'm excited. I'm excited because even if I'm always excited about the contents of the card itself, the best eras of WWE have always, without fail, come when they had competition. And I don't know if this will be true direct competition or not, but anything that makes WWE think about it and makes them more nervous is almost always good for the wrestling business.
Absolutely. And I think this is a hell of a card, too, to kick things off with. So, yeah, really good stuff there. And the road to WrestleMania is, for better or worse, taking shape. A lot of movement in the last couple of days on that, Nick.
Yes, the insertion of Charlotte Flair into the Raw Women's Main Event for WrestleMania has caused quite a bit of consternation online. What else do you say about that? It is what it is at this point. We all kind of coming. Mm-hmm. I would argue it shouldn't have been coming, but that's another topic.
Agreed.
For another day.
Yes, a singles would have been preferable, but the match should be good at least. Of course, most of the matches are good now. And we, of course, are heading full bore towards Brock Lesnar and Seth Rollins, and have no WWE Championship match in sight yet. But there are opportunities, perhaps, to be had there. In any event, also, New Japan news. We have a brand new IWGP heavyweight champion in a guy that I've been very critical of in the past, Switchblade Jay White. However, I'm going to give his title win a chance when it shows on Access and see what I think of it. What are your thoughts on this move, Nick? Surprising to you that Tanahashi only held on to the title for a little over a month?
Not that surprising, considering they kind of had made an effort to seemingly de-emphasize Tanahashi in years past, the last couple of years, really, and it felt like they only went with him in the main event because it was one of the few guys that Kenny Omega hadn't worked there at Wrestle Kingdom. And then when Kenny was leaving to go do AEW, you know, they kind of found themselves back into the position of putting the title on Tanahashi. But I always kind of thought it would be more of a short-term thing. I didn't think it would be this term, however, but here we are. Jay White is your new IWGP heavyweight champion. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has been the Wrestling 5 Minutes.
Absolutely. Well, with all that said, Nick, I think that's going to just about wrap us up. What do we have coming the way of the people in the next few weeks?
So like we said, we have coming up a review of Boom Studios' first volume of their WWE comic, which we're looking forward to. And then as we get into the month of March, we actually have one of our first of three consecutive theme months, Greg. I know you love when we do theme months. We're going to have Captain Marvel month here on the old Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Now, is that going to be Marvel Captain Marvel, DC Captain Marvel, or Captain Marvel?
We are going to be having Captain Marvel month from Marvel, and we are going to explore during that month, the plan is to explore a bit of every every person to be known as a little bit of every era of Captain Marvel. We're going to look at some Mar-Vell, we're going to look at some Carol Danvers, and we're even going to look at some Kamala Khan, I think, in the course of
what about Monica Rambeau?
Well, I don't, Greg, we're doing the best we can. Let me ask you, how much stuff do you want to read for Long Book next month?
What about, and then in April, we've got also Captain Marvel month, right? Or is that Shazam month?
Shazam month will be in April. And then, of course, May will be Avengers month. So lots of good stuff coming up.
Lots of good stuff there. But, of course, it wouldn't be a week of the IHTF now without our old pal, good old JR.
Yeah, good old
Nick. I understand that he's working his way through the studio now.
Yeah, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross is back with us again to sing us out with a little musical outro. And, you know, once again, we reach to the headlines, as we often do for inspiration here. And as you know, Greg, we're in the midst of award season. We're getting ready for the Oscars are coming up. We've had the Golden Globes in the past. And, you know, one of the big stories has been the nomination of Queen and Freddie Mercury biopic Bohemian Rhapsody for numerous awards, and how there's been some controversy with director Bryan Singer and him having to be distanced from the film a little bit. It continues to be an ongoing thing. It's very interesting. And so I thought, what better time to have Jim Ross do his own take on the Brestular Bohemian Rhapsody song than right now. So, Mr. Ross, take it away.
Well, thank you once again for that intro. Now, this is a song that I can really dig into. This is a band and a tune that I know real well. So I'm gonna warm up my pipes
here. Now, I must say, Mr. Ross, your rendition of Cardi B's Bodak Yellow has been getting rave reviews online and from the individuals at the airport. So congratulations on that.
Well, it's good to hear. You know, we always appreciate the support here on the show. Maybe throw us a review on iTunes. It means a lot, folks. It just takes a few moments of your time, and then but it means a lot to us. And you know, maybe people like that performance. They'll like my traveling road band. But then again, I know how the game works. I know there's going to be certain Richard on the internet. They're going to sit there. They're going to criticize. They're going to run their mouths. They're going to moan and bitch about JR's poking fun. I'm not poking fun at anyone when I do this. This is just me trying to have fun with my friends and singing a song. Speaking of which, is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? You know, we're caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes. Look up to the skies and see. Oh, I'm just a poor boy. I need no sympathy because I'm easy come, easy go, a little high to low. That's what they're saying on the internet. I can hear them right now. Anyway, the wind blows. It doesn't really matter to me. It doesn't matter to me. Listen, folks, to me, it does not matter. You can say what you want to say. Oh, I get it. You follow the rating. Oh, what are the ratings doing? That doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter who's heel or who's face. I just try to enjoy the product. Anyway, Mother Earth, I just killed a man. Put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, and now he is dead. Mother, life had just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mother, I didn't mean to make you cry. But if I'm not back again this time tomorrow, quite frankly, just carry on. Just shoot me, for God's sake. Carry on as if nothing really matters. Too late. My time's done come. You know, the very thought of the match between China and Ivory at WrestleMania 17 sends shivers down my spine. Body is aching all the time. Goodbye, everybody. So long. I've got to go. Got to leave you all behind and face the simple truth of the matter, which is that Mother, I don't want to die, for God's sake. But sometimes I do wish that I had never been born at all. Now, that's a depressing thought, isn't it, folks? Wish I'd never been born at all. I mean, that's something that I would hear from Jake Roberts from time to time when he was employed even by me and the head of talent relations. And what do you say to somebody in that situation? Hell, I don't know. I mean, but we've all been there, time or two. Anyway, I see a little silhouette of a man, Anthony Scaramucci, will you do the Fandango? Now, Fandango is a hell of a worker, in my opinion, but he is missing that little something. He is missing that it. Whatever it is, he is missing it, and he's got to find it. He has got to find himself as a character, take some time, and sell. For God's sake, if he would just sell a little bit, perhaps he and his partner would get a little bit more over than they are. They'd be as over as Thunderbolt Patterson and White Lightning Tim Horner. Very, very frightening me. Galileo Figaro Magnifico. I'm just a poor boy and nobody loves me. Oh, he's just a poor boy from a poor family. Spare him his life in this monstrosity. Well, you know, it's easy come, easy go. Will you let me go? Bismilla, no, we will not let you go. Bismilla, we will not let you go. Let him go! Bismilla, we will not let you go. Let him go! We'll not let you go. Let me go! Let me go! No. Oh, Mother Mia, let me go. Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me. For me! There's that part where they did the instrumental break, you know, he did a head banging and all that millennial crap. So you think you can stop me and fire my ass and spit in my eye? So you think you can love me and then leave me to die? Oh, baby, can't do this to me, baby. Just got to get out. I just got to get right out of Norman, Oklahoma, and on the road to promote my book, Slobberknocker. Oh, yeah. Nothing really matters. Anyone can see. Nothing really matters to me. Any way the wind. You know what? Blow me.
Hard traveling fanboys.